Welcome back to Barks Remarks. I'm Mark Severino, a grown man who enjoys duck comics, and I'm joined by two fellow grown men and duck comic lovers, both returning guests. I'm very excited to have them back on to talk about a great Scrooge treasure hunting classic, right? You guys, we all think about Scrooge McDuck with like treasure hunting, but if you actually really count it, there's surprisingly few that are kind of pure treasure hunt ones. And I've got to say, I'm going to try to temper myself a little because I am very tempted to gush about this one. I really love The Mines of King Solomon, but I'm eager to find out how my guests, who are Austin Kelly and Bucket Think Tank, feel about the story. So gentlemen, welcome back. Austin, tell us a little bit about your experience as a duck fan or anything else you've been up to lately.
Cool. Yeah, I'm Austin. I've been here a couple times. You know, I've had my share on the sort of Barks merry-go-round here. I've had a couple good stories, and this is another one. I think this is actually one of the first sort of full-length adventure Barks stories I ever read. And it's pretty good. I don't know if I'm as much of a fan as it as some other people are, but no, it's got some great art, some great one-liners, some really nice dialogue. So I'm excited. It'll be fun.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad that we're not all going to be gushing because like I said, it's good to hear another viewpoint. What about you, Bucket? Welcome back. And tell us first about your kind of experience as a duck and comics fan.
Oh, well, so the first comics I've read were Uncle Scrooge comics. That was it. Like, in a world where everyone's reading Batman and Superman, I was like, there's a duck on this cover. And it's not, his name's not Howard. I want it. And I came from DuckTales, so I was starving for anything more with a crotchety old cajillionaire who just goes around on adventures. So that's what led me to that. This story, I think I may have been about maybe 12 or 13 when I found this one. It was when I actually was going around to different comic book shops finding them. And this story is, I like it. I like the scale. I was a bit ashamed to realize I've never read The Mines of King Solomon, like the actual book. Might be my new goal for this year. It's like, you know, all these stories that have been like, you know, redone in film and whatnot. I'm just going to read the actual book.
I've got to say, I'm right there with you on both counts. I guess we should kind of go around. I have not read the book that this is. I guess I wouldn't say it's based on it, right? But it is alluding to a famous treasure hunting, kind of one of the first lost treasure stories that got some real fame. And Austin, you're holding up a copy. So yeah, is that for display, or have you read the sucker?
Okay, It's kind of disappointing because I have not gotten around to reading it yet. But I remember going through an old Eastridge bookstore in Manhattan, finding this copy on sale for $2. And I don't think I made the Barks connection yet because it just sounded like it's a cool story.
Right.
Probably would have been cool to read in preparation for the sort of compare.
Yeah, it's a lot of homework. Yeah, so I have not read it either. I'm familiar with it a little bit from... Has anyone here read the graphic novel, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
I've read half of it. It's hit and miss with the art for me.
It's a very particular art style. It's what's his name? The Watchman guy, right?
Alan Moore.
Yeah. That's the Alan Wizard. Moore. It's very famous. It was made into a terrible movie. But of course, the premise of that is that it takes all these like classic English adventure characters into one kind of crime fighting team. And I really enjoyed it for the most part, although it gets pretty dark. But Alan Quarterman is one of the characters in it. And he was in a series of books, and The Mines of King Solomon is probably the most famous of them, I'm guessing, right?
Probably. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I guess that's a good kind of jumping off point. We've been talking about the story. What do you guys know about King Solomon himself?
Not a lot, to be honest with you.
I'll raise that. I know even less. There you go.
Well, so I am not like super well versed in Solomon, but I went to enough Sunday school that, you know, the Solomon is a biblical figure, right? He is said to have written a lot of the Psalms from the Bible, including the famous Song of Solomon. And Solomon, the king, was renowned for like his wisdom. And he was known for one other thing, you guys. He was known for a very Scrooge McDuck-like thing. He is purported to have been one of the richest men in all of history, as the minds of this story would suggest. So I did know that already, but what I didn't know is that there's like apparently like an actual reference in the Bible to how much wealth he had. So get ready for this. He apparently, according to 1 Kings, this is the first time I've quoted a Bible verse in the podcast, you guys.
All right, we're getting biblical now.
Yeah, it's Sunday school, I guess. He was apparently, he had a vision from God and he was offered anything, but because he wanted to be a just king, he requested an understanding heart to fulfill his responsibilities as a king. And so the short of it is God did end up giving him that wisdom. You guys know the famous like tale of Solomon proclaiming that two parents needed to saw the baby in half when they had a dispute. Yeah, so he was like supposedly very wise. So he, God gave him that wisdom, but because he like made that noble request, he also gave him the wealth that he could have asked for. And then so by some measure, he apparently was given as tribute 25 tons of gold per year for the 40 years of his rule, which if you adjust it to modern currency is like 2.1 or 2.2 trillion dollars. Mm-hmm. So that's who we're dealing with, right? That's why King Solomon is like a natural target, I guess, for a Bark story. The only thing that does feel a little bit weird is that he is a biblical character, you know, and you don't usually see that referenced in these stories. Mm-hmm. But I think the fact that it was in the Allan Quatermain book, you know, that probably establishes it as not just a religious thing. I guess it's worth noting that most like historical scholars see not a ton of evidence for Solomon having been a real person, but like a lot of things, there's a lot of debate around that. But yeah, this is classic treasure hunting. This is going to be a really fun story, you guys. Bucket, you mentioned that you really thrilled to the treasure sequence in this one.
Yeah. I would say it's primarily from my experience with the DuckTales. One of the best moments is always when they find the treasure and Scrooge is like a kid at Toys R Us and his parents gave him like $100. You know, it's kind right. of it. The world is his oyster. The difference is Scrooge gets the money and the toys in this case. He just sort of loses it. It's fun. It's great. It's an embarrassment of riches and it's fun because Scrooge is pretty much going through a, almost like his ideal candy store. He sees like the bare minimum candy, like, yeah, that's all right. And then he gets to the good candy, the candy in the back, you know, with the extra sugar, the real chocolate, you know, the scrum diddly umptious bars, you know. Yeah. So it's always fun to see Scrooge act like that.
It's a great scene. And Barks does really well with those. So we'll have to pay special attention to that sequence when we get to it. Austin, I don't know about you, but like as a kid for me, the animal whistles were really where it was at. Like I loved those.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting the way Barks comes up with these devices that are so outrageous in a world where things are already incredibly outrageous, like this duck who has more money than all of mankind. These devices like the whistle almost carry the story because they can take it anywhere, right? The whistle comes into play so many times in this story and it does so many different things. It's actually, obviously Barks thought it was really cool because he brought the exact idea back for another Scrooge adventure later in the 60s. It was So Far and No Safari, which is a little sillier, but it's a good story as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. The animal whistles. I had endless appetite for them. I could have had them every other story as far as I was concerned, but I was just obsessed with the animals as a kid. So this definitely hit the sweet spot for me. So you guys, there's going to be a lot of fun stuff to talk about. Let's hone in on a little bit of the background about this specific story. We are dealing with Uncle Scrooge number 19 is the issue that it was first published in. And that was in July of 1957 was the cover date. You guys, I was kind of surprised when I looked at the reprints for this one because it only had 8 U.S. printings, including the original, which is kind of unusually few to me. But I guess it stands to reason because like most of these Bark stories, I have 2 or 3 or 4 different printings of them. But I have this one solitary one from the Giant Gladstone album, number 1. Maybe because it was number 1, I felt like it was unusually special. But I love the story. I read it till it was dog-eared and the cover fell off. I really need to replace that copy. It is a fairly long story as far as Bark's adventures go once he wasn't allowed to do the 32-pagers anymore. So we've got a 27-page one. And I don't have a ton of background trivia for this, but I did read that apparently Bark's created some potential covers for this one, but the editors ended up going with the snake charming one instead. Austin, you were nodding. Did you read about that too?
Yeah, I was about to say the Dell books always started at least around this time with like some grand adventure story. And outside of like the 4-color series where like Bark's did all those cool covers, the covers were like such wasted potential. They were just gags. And so Bark's did do a bunch of covers that were story specific for Scrooge 19, and Dell did not use any of them. But the Gladstone album has one of them, I think, re-inked on there on the cover. So that's...
Yeah, I think it's a different artist, but he used like one of Bark's concepts. I don't remember. Yeah. Gladstone did some great work. I feel like they essentially created the Disney comic fandom, right? Because they're the first people who named these creators and who gave a darn about them. Jeffrey Blum actually has a really cool little line in his commentary here. I'm just going to read it really quickly. He notes that for his series of Scrooge comics, Bark's evolved a formula on which he could play infinite variations, the treasure hunt. Archaeology is interesting to practically everybody, Bark's once remarked. Sorry, I just said my podcast name there. And the old lost treasure gimmick is forever popular with kids. And that was Bark's quote. So expeditions to foreign lands could fuse a smattering of myth, a dash of history, a capsule geography lesson, and a generous helping of high adventure. I really like that. I think that it really gets at the essence of what to me makes this story really special is that it is, if you look a little bit deeper into this one, it is incredibly educational. He is teaching us so much about these. Each sequence is like this little micro geography lesson for a young kid. And I invite you guys to pay careful attention to some of the vocabulary that he sprinkles in this one. It is so respectful of his young reader's intellect. There is some vocabulary in this one that really shocks me. I'm going to say, and I'll say later more about why, but I think this is sorely underrated when we'll get to the index rating on this one. Oh, so you guys, again, I had mentioned a little bit that Solomon is, you know, his provenance is kind of dubious, but there is some archaeological evidence that maybe there were King Solomon's mines, and they've found that the site might be in modern day Timna Park in southern Israel. So I found that interesting.
In regards to the sort of educational aspect to it, when I was looking at just the first page, I was for some reason reminded of the story Scrooge and Money, which is Huey, Dewey, and Louie come asking their uncle, like, hey, we got a piggy bank with $1.95, and they learned about money. And I thought Scrooge is very good for that, the sort of premise. And it's really just because, you know, he's 900 something years old, depending on your story.
Sure.
And he has a wealth of knowledge from different cultures and different whatnot. He really could have been like Ludwig von Drake in the fact that he could teach kids about something, this new concept today. And because he needs to go just about anywhere, you could do that. You could do a whole sort of National Geographic with Scrooge and find out here's how you make money while you're at this place too. The adventure aspect is something too, because when I think of the adventure and the archaeology, I think of two things. The Life of Scrooge, Part 7, which is like my least favorite of that. It's a good story, which is kind of boring, but that's also where Scrooge gains an appreciation for history and archaeology, and as well as the DuckTales movie cover, because in that one, Scrooge is basically just Indiana Jones.
It's a very absorbing cover, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, thank you. Let's see, you guys. I'm excited to get into this one. I would be remiss, though, if I didn't pander a little bit to the international listeners. So you guys, I have curated three titles from around the world, and I'm going to go ahead and do the first one. I'm going to go with the French title, which I found really interesting. It was, at least in a couple of printings, called Harpagon et les mines du roi Salomon. So that's like Harpagon and the mines of King Solomon. And that makes it sound like Scrooge's name should be Harpagon or Harpagon. But apparently that is like a famous French story. That's the word for the miser in France. So I'm thinking from context that they're just referencing him as like the ultimate miser. So I found that interesting. Let's see. Austin, you want to hit us with yours?
This one's from Germany. It's going to be a little tough to pronounce. Title is Ischachkamen König Salomos, which would be the treasury of King Solomon. Pretty straightforward.
Right. And most of them, other than this one and the one Bucket's going to do, ended up being basically, you know, this is an easy one to come up with a title for. All right, Bucket, hit us.
All right. In Italy, in Italian, it's Paperone de Paperoni e il Cogendo di Camelli, which is Scrooge McDuck and the Camel's Leave, which is actually like the weirdest title here.
Right. It seems like it's referring to the moment when the kids whistle away the bandits' camels, but what a weird part to like hang the title of the story on, right?
I mean, technically it's the part where thankfully they don't die, so yeah, it's an important part for the kids.
I guess when you put it that way, it's pretty important. Awesome. All right, you guys, I can't wait. I get such a kick. I get such a kick out of this story. I will say I don't think it's like one of the all-time greats, mostly because it doesn't really have like a strong theme. But kind of like The Secret of Atlantis, it's just really an incredibly solid adventure story. Maybe Seven Cities of Cibola might be a good reference point. But anyway, let's do this. So we open up with a kind of an unusual opening, you guys. It is extremely busy. It's very frenetic. And Bark's narrator box does a lot of the work here. It says that every once in a while, Uncle Scrooge must make a tour of inspection of his many properties. And Bark's does some great signaling by showing his office like completely buried in money. So he's standing on his desk. And he is demanding his clerks, who are all running frantically in the background, bring him his ticket to his bank in Zanzibar by way of Antofagasta, Kankakee, Botafogo, Chilifut, Baghdad, Wagga Wagga, and Mongoosia. And essentially, the clerks come in with what is going to be almost the story's sixth character, the giant ticket that is going to take the ducks just traipsing all around the world. I love this, you guys. The lead clerk comes in saying, it needs to be said because we got these specific numbers. We've got your ticket and passports in order for visits to 1,200 places in 69 countries with 16 crossings of the seven seas. And it's just this connected ticket, and it's a big old train. And Scrooge asks if they remembered to include passage for his nephews. And when he gets the confirmation and the clerk wonders why, he says, "To help me carry the ticket, you schnooks." I love it, you guys. This opening cracks me up. It's so compelling. It promises all this globe-trotting. It sets up a great reason to bring the nephews. I think this is a masterpiece of an opening.
Yeah, it just starts off with so much energy. When I think of how these stories usually start, at least some of my favorite, just Scrooge in his office. It's dark, it's gloomy. He's like, who owes me money today? And, but here, it's like, no, this is the day. We're checking everything I own, making sure everything's working, see who I need to fire, all right? Who also may owe me money, you know, just in case, you know, do what you're good with. And you just can't help but love it. This could be like a two-part movie.
Yeah, we don't always get kind of the business dealings, right? What do you think, Austin?
Yeah, I agree. It's a really nice, energetic opening, and it sets up a lot of that, sort of the thrill of adventure. We don't get a lot of the business side of Scrooge. I mean, we know he put in a lot of work to get the money, but you don't often see how he sort of upholds that. So this story kind of puts him in the position of like, he's got a lot of money in this and that, and he actually cares enough about all these things to, you know, visit them all once in a while. So I think it's interesting the way they set up his fortune as well.
Right. Because you would imagine this is what it would take. And it doesn't make for the most engaging story under most circumstances, right? Like what it takes for a global tycoon to keep his empire running. But Barks does an amazing job, I think, of getting some juice out of it. Hey, Bucket, why don't you tell us about this next sequence, the kind of the bus stop and the introduction of the animal whistles?
All right. So in our next sequence, we've got Donald and the boys waiting at the bus stop. Rather, Donald is waiting at the bus stop. And the nephews are hanging out in the grass in the bushes. And they are working on their bird and animal calls for their junior woodchucks woodcraft class. In other words, they have crafted whistles that will control animals, or rather, call animals. It almost feels like they've found a way to weaponize Mati's power of heart from Captain Planet. And Donald, who would probably be impressed with this, like, you know, we don't have that. We have a job to do. Get in line for the bus. And they'll be traveling to lands where the animals are so wild they won't know a call from Scat.
Yeah, it's a great setup, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of insane when you think that this is in the Junior Woodchuck Guidebook. It's like a James Bond manual for like right.
the animal whistles, of course, are nonsense. They're basically this side of magic, but they are such a great gimmick for a kid reader. I found it super compelling. We've got some kind of rapid fire little sequences coming up here. And note you guys that we've had two things set up, right? We've had the globe trotting, the inspection set up, and we've had the animal whistle set up. And now we're going to see these different sequences and how those two elements of this story keep colliding with each other in a really organic, really entertaining way. So we get this really brisk. Tell us, Austin, tell us what happens at the station.
Sure. So Scrooge and the ducks are at the station. And as Scrooge promised, he's just brought the nephews along to carry the tickets. And as they're carrying them, the nephews start blowing this animal whistle and a bunch of little mice run out, which is a pretty funny visual. And I think it's interesting the way that, like you said, the worlds are sort of colliding now, the two setups, because they're going to keep intertwining closer and closer, of course, until like the climax.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Barks is dropping in. He's name dropping locations, right? He has the nephews say, no fun in getting to Singapore and finding out they'd eaten us out of a ticket home. So he's going to do this little thing where he mixes kind of animals, geography, and history all together here in a way that I find really informative. Bucket, why don't you tell us about the first stop in one of my my former home state of Arizona?
Well, the first stop is Scrooge's copper mine in Arizona. It's a 15-mile hole. And of course, because it's just a hole, the boys are kind of bored. So, you know, they're looking for animals and they decide to give a few mixed calls. And it turns out the boys have called a ring of Gila monsters, which, you know, are not dangerous to humans per se, but they do eat birds. So, so Gila monsters, they're not that frightening. I looked them up, like actually a few minutes before we came on. And they aren't that dangerous. Like, they're not dangerous to humans, but they do eat birds. So that just kind of worked out here on the terms of threat level.
And, yeah, if you're an Arizonan, you're pretty familiar with them. They're scary, but they're always a little bigger than they feel like they should be. It's a funny bit, right? Like it's our first taste. We're kind of bouncing back and forth where it was useful in the train station, but now it's going to be a nuisance. And then our next sequence is a little quick return to the Andes, you know, where they're inspecting his silver bars. And we see Donald and Scrooge gasping from the altitude here. It's very silly that there's an altitude sign right there, you guys. But I feel like, again, this is like this mini education, right? I'm learning that silver comes from the Andes. As a kid, I didn't really have this idea that it was hard to take high altitudes. And then when the nephews call their llamas to, as they say, a fleet of llama taxis to give their uncles a ride, it's very cute. But look at in these four really brisk panels, I've learned kind of a shocking amount about the Andes and Bolivia.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of stuff that Barks sort of seeps into this story. And I think this is one key factor that sort of differs Barks from Rosa, who a lot of people consider his successor. But when Rosa tries to educate in his stories, a lot of time, like he educates in ways like this, where it sort of blends into the scenery. And like you get some gags, but there are a lot of panels of Scrooge just like talking or reading from like some old book. Yeah. Here, Bart makes it interesting. And we actually get some action where, you know, they start getting short of breath because they're in altitude. And so it's really interesting the way he conveys the information to you as opposed to just telling you right out.
Right. I think you're right. Rosa is often very successful at it, as Barks is, but then sometimes he does get a little bit expository about things. And then we get another of these cool sequences where we go to Baggy Breeches, India. It's a silly little made up name, but I learned very quickly that tea comes from India because they're inspecting his largest tea plantation. And when the nephews try to call some monkeys, they accidentally call some ravenous tigers. It's a good bit. And again, it's very brisk. It's really informative. It feels like there's more of these travels than really there even are. But I love it. Austin, you want to tell us about the Alaska sequence in Chillifoot, Alaska?
We go to Chillifoot, Alaska, where Scrooge is checking in on his salmon cannery. And there's a problem with the salmon where they're staying out beyond the breakwater. And so, of course, this is a good time to show the animal whistle and what it can do. So the nephews blow it and it proves to be a bit of a nuisance. And not only do they call all the salmon back to the dock, but also bring in a bunch of whales that provide a bit of a cool splash panel with everything sort of crashing and the ducks just running away.
I love the comic timing of that panel. I think it's great. It really works for me. Again, we've got the same thing. We've got this interplay between the inspection and the animal whistle. And you know, at this point, Barks has really kind of laid the groundwork well enough that we get the idea. I think just at the right time, he breaks it up here. And now we're going to go for the kind of the meat of the story. We're going to get a much more extended sequence in. Austin, do you want to hit us with the last line of that sequence when the nephew is running away from Scrooge wielding a stitch?
Sure. So the noise that the nephews have been blowing into the whistle is what the handbook calls a chug gluck. And so as Scrooge chases them with a twig, one of the nephews says, "I'm sorry, Uncle Scrooge. I must have hit that last chug gluck too hard."
I don't know why, but that cracks me up.
That chug gluck looks really thick for the sound effect.
Yeah. Yeah, he does some good visual signaling there. So we are transitioning now to Sweden for a little stopover. I'm so glad, you guys, about some of these places that I get to add pins on the map for. Because the ducks haven't been to Sweden before. So the plan is to inspect his fine glassware factory. And Scrooge is concerned at this point about them calling in a proverbial or literal bull into the goblet shop. And Donald clothespins their beaks shut just to ensure it. It's just a little sight gag. We don't really return to that. We learn about the issue with his glass business, which in brief is that now they can't get the special sand anymore that made this fine crystal. And so he gives the manager gives Scrooge the contact for two Arab brothers whose ancestors, he says, have been owners of the business since the days of the pharaohs. And so Scrooge, of course, is going to be there anyway to inspect his oil fields in Iraq, and he's going to check it out. And you guys, we get this neat little sequence where they're flying over the deserts of Iraq, and we get some good expository dialogue from Scrooge. I like how Barks handles this. Austin, what do you think?
Yeah, I was about to add on. I agree. It's sort of interesting in the sense that it's brief. It's only a couple sentences that Scrooge sort of rattles off. And he actually ends it by sort of leading into the next segment, if you want to call it that, by asking, like, who knows? Maybe a city lies buried beneath us now, you know, sort of foreshadowing what's going to go on later.
Right. You want to keep reading that quote? It's a good one.
Sure. He goes, who knows? Maybe a city lies buried beneath us now. A city where the caravans of King Solomon rested with their cargoes of gold.
Right. So we get our little mention of some of the riches of the ancient world. And they name drop King Solomon just so that we're cued to know that. And then we come to a village on the western shore of the Red Sea where Scrooge can get some information about the Arab brothers. And Bucket, you want to tell us about this exchange?
Oh, yeah. So Scrooge goes and chats it up with the locals. And Scrooge pointing out that he learned the language when he sold lawnmowers in the Sahara, you know, which is always a cool little nod. And he says they came in one day with their camels loaded with sand and took the boat to Jida, sandbags and all. And the villagers said they'd found a rich treasure. He describes some diamonds that fell from one of their sandbags. And he says that he's sure they dug it into an ancient king's cache, and you bet there's more that they didn't find. So this is sort of where our story now goes. Like, you know what? Maybe there's not a city there, but I'd like to scratch around in the quarry just to see. And first things first, though, make sure we take the tickets, all right? That cannot leave our sight, all right? We cannot go through this mission without a way to get home, no matter what happens.
Isn't this funny, you guys? Like, we're so accustomed to flying in and checking in with our QR codes. But there was the day when, you know, you had to have your paper ticket. I love the nephews' faces as they blanch at grabbing. I like how they call it the ticket, right? It's really this entity with hundreds of them connected to each other, but it is the ticket.
Yeah, because theoretically only one ticket, there's only like one ticket for each of them that would go to Duckburg. So, you know, technically it is the ticket.
So you guys, we're going to transition towards this location. All of this is just setting up very nicely kind of how remote we're going to get, how kind of away from, quote, civilization we are. They've got a guide who's taking them through what's just a camel trail. And they're heading to this quarry. And at some point, there's a rock fall where that makes it so that they have to head in on foot. I don't know if I'm just reading too much into it, you guys, but during this sequence, it kind of feels very ominous to me, like very eerie, like they're just, you know, really about to walk into some danger. And you can tell that Donald feels uneasy, but Scrooge says, no, my old prospector's nose tells me we're on the trail of something big. We'll go on. And of course, they have to go on with that ticket as well.
I think it's interesting. I agree that this is sort of the sequence, the page that sets up like, hey, these guys have, you know, traveled the world. Now they have a tour guide driving them to what is almost like the edge of civilization. And it almost seems like fate has stopped them. They've thrown these rocks down and everything is telling them not to go, but they keep going on foot, which seems like a horrible idea, except for the prospector's nose telling Scrooge that there is something big coming up. So, of course, they have to go on.
Right. Yeah. Austin, why don't you tell us about the exchange that the nephew has with their chauffeur? And again, the word chauffeur is like very common, you know, for, but as a kid, I'm pretty confident this was the first time that I had encountered it. There's just a lot of dialogue here that uses, where Barks uses a lot of really interesting vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Okay, so one of the nephews is getting a little wise to the situation, runs over to the chauffeur and asks why the whole town isn't coming up here, sort of looking around for the diamonds that are supposed to be hidden around. And the chauffeur says that they've all been there, and we found was a fight, because the raiders of El Jackal, the awful, had heard of the diamonds as well. And in the middle of a sentence, chauffeur just drives off and assumes that the nephews might have better luck because El Jackal may have given up the search by now.
Right. Very ominous. What do you think, Bucket?
I think it's a bit concerning that, you know, the chauffeur didn't tell them about the raiders before. But, right. It, you know, no risk, no reward, but it sort of makes sense. The danger element can't just be, some obstacles that may be there naturally or unnaturally. Like maybe the Arab brothers did decide to hide the whole place down so no one else could find it. Or, you know, maybe just the way things work out. But, you know, El Jackal the Awful is, first of all, a great name. A great, great name. It's almost like a wrestling name. But, it's a great way to let you know, hey, there's some other stuff out here. They may be booby traps because, you know, we may be looking for a treasure or maybe a mine, but there is a sort of outside force totally unrelated to the mines that you should be wary of, which they really should have told them before we drove them out and just left them in the desert.
Yeah, it's a good thing the nephew asked. Do you guys know what a Bedouin is?
No.
Bedouin is just a term for like nomadic peoples that lived in that live still in the area. I believe they pull up camp and are frequently moving around. He's billed as the Bedouin Raiders. So the ducks and the ticket, of course, set off for the quarry following Scrooge's hunch that we're homing in on something big. And, they pass some ancient writings on a cliff face, which is another opportunity, of course, for the Junior Woodchuck's guidebook to come into play. And when the nephew translates it, he finds that it says, "I, Punjab, captain of King Solomon's caravans, passed this way with 40 camels laden with gold and jewels." I really like Scrooge's reaction there. He's just getting ecstatic with anticipation.
So after Scrooge gets really excited and almost loses his glasses, he says, "Come on, I can hardly hold my horses till we get over this hill." So they keep going. And the boys say, "You know, we can call some camels." All right. And so they do the camels. They do the tweem, twonk, twunk, you know, the language of camels. And there's the galloping. And the problem is, while they do have camels, these camels have riders. And we can presume it's El Jackal the Awful.
That's right. We don't get him. We don't get his introduction right away. But I would say his face precedes him. Right. He's very vicious looking.
Even his camel looks angry.
I know. Right. You guys, I love the transliterations of the animal noises. They're all great. And then Austin, he does introduce himself as El Jackal the Bedouin, and the ducks try and play it off. Do you want to tell us about this narrow escape?
Sure. So they run into El Jackal, and of course Scrooge sort of just tries to play it off, says he's a sand buyer, but one of El Jackal's accomplices says he spins tales. It is plain he comes to search for the brothers' treasure find. So El Jackal's a little wise, and he tells everyone to seize the trespassers and can sort of tell that Scrooge is rich and that he's going to fetch a godly price, which he says. So by now, the animal whistle has been set up as something that could be good or bad. It could really go anyway. So it's interesting that the nephews figure it's their only chance to do anything. So they pull it out and try to figure out how to send camels away. And the code for that in the whistle is a tweef twerf, which they blow and they lead all the camels and everyone on them, including El Jackal, off into the distance.
Right. I like how you point out that they are both the problem and the solution to so many things in this story. And so you guys, the ducks are safe, but Scrooge has this chance again to turn back, and he's not going to take it, right? He is too determined. He is seeing dollar signs and thinking that they can now elude him easily in the Rocky Hills. And so eventually they do approach that quarry, and they see what they call, what Scrooge calls, a bedlam of Bedouins, a nice little bit of alliteration there. And Scrooge peeps in and hears that, you know, half of his men are going to be looking for them. The others are heading to the main camp, and they're preparing to give one last look for the supposed cache of jewels, if it even exists. And so this frees up the ducks to take a good look around the joint. And they do eventually encounter the sand that was the instigation for the whole discovery. Just in brief, you know, they notice that the sand is distinct from the sand in the quarry. Again, I'm going to say that this was the first time I ever encountered the word quarry as a kid. That they found some like reddish streaks in the sand that Scrooge says might indicate, you know, chunks of a crumbling brick wall, possibly a hidden, you know, buried city. So they've at least got that lead, and they start to look around. And I like how the nephews kind of get look for the opportunity to take a little break here, Bucket. But they do have an ulterior motive too. You want to tell us about this sequence?
Yeah, so while they're mature, always smart adults, go wandering off around the desert, Louis suggests, like, you know what? There might be a better way. We're looking for a cave or something, right? So what's in a cave? Bats. All right, so hear us out. We are going to do a supersonic squeak. So let's blow. And we got a skeel, which I guess calls bats. And it does. It calls bats. They're coming out there all for the raid. Like, you know, where's the party at? And so they call their uncles down, and they found something big, and they arrive at a small little cave entrance. But as they get closer to it, they find a hook, and they pull the hook and reveals that it is actually a cover, and it reveals a doorway. And we've like really stumbled onto something awesome here.
Yeah, you guys, I don't know about you both, but I love the way that they find the city. I find it very narratively satisfying. You know, they've used the whistles in a really clever way. The entrance itself is hidden in a really clever way. Both of those elements to me are very visually satisfying. What do you think, Austin?
Yeah, I agree. I like also that the nephews, as usual, are the ones who like make the most progress in the trip or get the most work done. After all these years, Scrooge and Donald still, you know, brush them aside and just leave them out to dry. But they actually end up, you know, getting a bigger lead on the treasure than Scrooge and Donald probably could have ever gotten.
Right.
I think it's also really good that, you know, the way this treasure is hidden isn't obvious. Like, it's one thing that can make or break a treasure hunt where you go like, oh, so anyone could have seen it? Like, actually, no, very next to no one would have seen this. They'd have walked by it 1,000 times.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right there, because it is very convincing. And that does make it more satisfying. You know, there's all these little cliff faces that the bats could have come out of. And it's easy to imagine someone searching them for months. And like you say, who's going to notice that little ring? It's a great introduction, and we're about to get one of Bark's probably best like treasure discovery scenes here, I think, right? Because we're going to enter. Scrooge describes the building that they are walking into as a temple or something hewn out of the hill. Do you guys know the word hewn?
No.
Nah.
I mean, I do, but like, I'm a 43-year-old now. Like, as a kid, I had to kind of like figure, okay, it's been carved out of the rock, something like carved out, right? That's some really nice vocabulary that Barks is slipping into his story for 6 through whatever year olds. You know, I mean, I talked to someone today who has started reading these with his dad at age 2, right? So for younger readers. So there's this quick little moment where they kind of like reconcile the fact that, oh, should we go in? The Arab brothers wouldn't want us to poke around. But, you know, as Scrooge looks at some of the carvings, he can tell that, you know, this is something that used to belong to royalty. So you guys, at this point, we know it's big, but the ducks haven't realized yet how big. They do eventually find the crumbling wall where the brothers must have gotten that fine sand. And as they kind of make their way back into the wall, then it becomes a little more clear because we do see, Bucket, you called it like the appetizer or something, right? We get teased with what looks like a great fortune here, just these rocks in these precious gems in the walls. That's enough to excite the reader and to excite Scrooge. And the ducks, Scrooge wants to tear into those catacombs. But first, one of the nephews convinces him to read what's written on the walls. Austin, do you want to tell us what Scrooge learns?
Sure. So Junior Woodchuck book comes in handy again. One of the nephews translates the text on the wall, says, "I, Pharaoh so-and-so of Egypt, give these mines to my son-in-law to be his forever." Scrooge doesn't really get it at first, until the nephew reveals that the son-in-law was King Solomon. So, you know, they've stumbled onto King Solomon's mines, which, of course, gets Scrooge really super excited.
Right. Do you guys love how the nephew played that kind of little, like, he really presented that well, right?
Didn't know how to pronounce the Pharaoh's name. It's like, I can't say Steve. Pharaoh so-and-so. There we go. I knew Pharaoh so-and-so. Great guy, actually.
I think he was doing it because I don't know if we know who he was, but that might have given it away, is my thought. But there's so much to love about this sequence. You know, Scrooge saying, "Hold me down before I float away," reconciling, "That's why my old prospector's nose was twitching. It was on the trail of King Solomon's mines." Oh, you guys, what a sequence this is coming up here, the wealth sequence.
It's great.
Bucket, I know you love this part. Do you want to tell us about this? And then Austin and I can just maybe pick out our favorite panels from it.
All right. So they go in, they find festoons of diamonds hanging from the ceiling like rock candy.
We found a workshop. Sorry to interrupt, but festoons? What's a festoon? Like, Barks is using some killer language here. Okay, go ahead. Keep at it.
A workshop where jewelers cut and polish stones, urns full of rubies and opals and jades, and veins of turquoise in the floor as broad as a sidewalk, gold nuggets like hen's eggs pouring out of the crannies of the rocks, mounds of amethysts, agates, garnets, and opals, the cast of Steven Universe, the cheaper jewels, you know, the scrap heap, and Scrooge just kind of wants to, like, you know, stay here for weeks and just feast on all this beautiful wealth, and, Louis, like, you know, we only have like a few cookies. That's not going to happen. He points out we'd better do something about the tracks outside. And Scrooge, who probably should take this into consideration, it does what he always does. When he sees the gold or the treasure, he's not thinking clearly. He's once again is that big kid.
Yeah, he gets some blinders. These are some great panels. Austin, anything that really stands out to you?
No, I mean, I like the whole sequence. I really like the visual of the diamonds hanging like rock candy. I think it's pretty cool. I like that it sort of provides a bit of an interesting hit for the narrative where Scrooge and like his greediness sort of prevent him from making any rational decision. Like, because he isn't thinking about anything but the treasure, he's not taking the footprints into consideration at all. So it's interesting because that's going to come into play later, of course.
Right. Yeah, he specifically says, "You just forget about El Jackal. A wind will come up in the night and erase those tracks." I did a story not too long ago where he had said something similar. It might have been Riches Everywhere. I don't remember. He did the same exact like wishful thinking. moment here. But yeah, this is just like zillionaire's heaven for him. He's just going to swim around in this. And we get a little moment where this is interesting. Barks doesn't usually kind of talk about the ramifications of the treasure hunt. But you know, he has him talking about how he's going to make a deal with the government to mine it for shares. So there's this weird little acknowledgement that like maybe the days of treasure hunting are a little bit more complicated, kind of in the post-colonial era. You know, a lot of the earlier Scrooge treasure hunts didn't really take those sort of like UN style laws. This is his, I think that's kind of his effort to like acknowledge that or something. But yeah, the night passes and we get a fun moment of Donald complaining about his back having slept on gems. Scrooge says he's going to need to get used to that because they're going to need to stay here for a while and guard the mine. That sounds unpleasant. But Scrooge wants to take the ticket out to the daylight to see if there's a paid up section to Cairo so that he can get on that business. I guess then we must be in Egypt for this sequence, right? Oh, this is awkward. I guess this story would have been before the Six Days War, Israel's big war against Egypt and Syria, which saw them take some of Sinai. Anyway, I wonder if this is kind of disputed land. So Scrooge and the nephew get outside and we get a very ominous exchange where Huey says, "Sure is quiet outside, Uncle Scrooge. I guess it's Louie. But in my edition, the colorer has done a red hat, but Scrooge is talking to Louie." So, you know.
Fantagraphics one.
So anyway, he says, "Sure is quiet outside, Uncle Scrooge. I'd hoped to see a wind blowing." And we see that Scrooge's wishful thinking has not paid off because they're completely exposed. Austin, why don't you tell us about this sequence here?
Sure. Well, Louie and Scrooge come out of the mine and see that their footprints are still there in a pretty cool panel that just shows like the empty distance. And so they start to panic a little until they realize that El Jackal and his gang are already there. So Scrooge, of course, tells Louie to blow the animal whistle and get that same camel away call. But Louie actually panics and instead just calls a bunch of bats, which leaves the ducks helpless, sort of just sitting there with nothing else to do. And Louie notes that there's a sound button that he forgot to turn, which I guess sort of controls the different frequencies and types of whistles you can call.
Right. I think we get to see a little more detail in that So Far and No Safari. It looks like they kind of turn a couple of dials to adjust it and modulate it. I like this sequence, you guys. It feels very natural, like someone might panic and do this, you know. And then this feels like some real danger to me, you know. It feels like there's some real consequences to this.
Yeah, this is aggressive. I mean, look at Scrooge's face in that panel. Like, he looks really frightened. And El Jackal is actually holding Scrooge upside down by his right ankle, which is super aggressive, and drops him and lets him land on his head. So I agree, it is it's pretty tense.
Right.
Yeah, it's like there's a sense of urgency, like when they see the footprints, and then El Jackal almost sort of morphs into the story, but you get the feeling that he was in no rush. Like, okay, this is where they are. We'll find them. It all of a sudden, it's become dangerous again. First, we just had the idea of danger, as with Sam, because there's nothing they can do right now. What they're really hoping for is Donald and the other boys can come in and we'll find some sort of plan.
Right. Yeah, the stakes have really gone up. And as you mentioned, you know, Louie has managed to slip back inside, hopefully to warn the other ducks, but he's gotten lost and the bats have extinguished their torches. So he starts calling for the other ducks, but they're in pitch black. And so all of the ducks seem to be in real dire straits here. And we flash back to Scrooge being held captive by El Jackal. who's planning to take the jewels, whatever jewels he's found. So it's very important at this point. He doesn't know the extent of the find. And he plans to hold him for a ransom. And that ransom there, you guys, I'm going to cut myself off for a moment because I meant to ask you, what do you guys think of the fourth panel on this page where Scrooge is under the bandit's heel and he is just agonizing, saying, all of this work for nothing, all of this wealth that King Solomon hid for centuries, to think that it's falling into the hands of bandits. Any thoughts?
It sort of falls into maybe this idea of how Scrooge sort of views great treasures and great wealth in the hands of great men. You could argue Scrooge has this issue with someone like bandits who really have no interest in making their own money on any level. They'd rather just take it. And they're taking this great wealth made by someone else. Like Scrooge was going to make use of that money. Not just he's going to swim in it and, you know, toss it, let it hit him on the head. But, you know, he's also a businessman. He creates jobs. He creates something of value.
Sure. I just find it interesting that, like, he feels like he deserves it. And I mean, does he really have a better case than the bandits, Austin?
No, I mean, I guess he does. But I think he's being a little greedy here. But, I mean, you know, that is his character. It is in his name to be a Scrooge. I think this panel in particular is interesting. It's what I would call super Rosa, for lack of a better term, which is good because Rosa put a lot of emphasis on Scrooge's motivation and made him into this hero that would really stand up for himself. I mean, Barks did that, but not to the extent that Rosa would. And we see glimpses of it here, and it adds a lot of nice tension, like a nice drawing. And, you know, he's literally under El Jackal's heel, which is pretty rough.
Yeah. You can actually see this also in, say, the Treasure of the Golden Suns story with DuckTales, when El Capitan, who's like a diet version of El Jackal, if you think about it, he tries to take the treasure, and Scrooge finds great offense to that because, you know, he was the one that did all this work to find it. Team Scrooge is right. The one that did this. So, you know.
Yeah, I think you guys are both right. I think, you know, Scrooge really views himself as worthy of it. It just kind of points out some of the modern problems with treasure hunting, right? Like there's all these inconveniences with the reality of treasure hunting. Like some government really owns it. You know, who does it really belong to? That Barks doesn't usually, he usually kind of waves them away because you almost have to. You know, boy, Bucket, it's really occurring to me as you talk about this, that this story, more than almost any other, might be the most DuckTales template story that there is. I don't know. I might have to chew that over, but I can't think of many other stories that feel more like they directly inspired the ethos of the DuckTales series. Maybe we'll come back to that.
An adventurous treasure hunt is sort of classic DuckTales. It's fine. It's out of that. Or the Beagle Boys of Magica want to rob Scrooge. That's kind of it.
So you guys, I love this next sequence. It's very goofy, but in spirit with Scrooge kind of thinking of himself as being the only one who deserves the treasure, he is outraged and he says, "You roughneck hobos, what do you need the money for? What would you do with it?" And El Jackal laughs it off because he's like, he thinks that just because we're rough, we have no taste. One of the bandits says, "Is that El Jacko?" And they made a weird coloring change. Anyway, one of the bandits says, "Me, I've got expensive tastes. I'd travel. I've always wanted to see the Chicago stockyards." And you guys, this is such a random and weird, but to me, very funny setup. The Barks very quickly establishes these Bedouins as like would-be world travelers. and they take a look in the leathern hamper. Again, another vocabulary term that I would not have known at all. That the duck seems to value highly. They look inside and they find their ticket, their monster travel pass to just about every place in the world. And we're rattling off the different place names, and all these bandits are at this point, they're like, "Well, you know, there's hypothetical wealth in that cave. We don't know how hard it's going to get to be. That's all I can think of as to why they, you know, overlooked the jewels in favor of a few tens of thousands of dollars of travel. But they all start to grab the big sections of the ticket, and they gallop off to see the world. Everyone except for El Jackal.
It's a fun sequence. It's sort of like, you know, we're kind of nomads because our parents were nomads. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the rest of the world. What do we have here? Well, we have desert. On a good day, we have really good desert. You know, you've seen one sand dune, you've kind of seen them all, but Chicago, which is mentioned like three separate times here, is, you know, have you been to Chicago? There's no sand in Chicago. Right. I don't know what that's like. One dude wants to see icebergs, which is like the polar opposite of sand. So, yeah.
Right.
It also shows no loyalty in this group.
No, because they totally leave El Jackal in the lurch. And so Scrooge plans to turn the tables on him and collect the government reward for bandits. And he calls to the kids to help tie up the hoodlum. And this is enough to kind of whisk El Jackal out of the story, too, as he has, quote, suddenly remembered that I've always wanted to travel, too. Austin, you want to tell us what he yearns?
He says, I've yearned to see Jamaica. And then he jumps on the camel and runs off.
Right. He wants to strike up a calypso. and you want to continue a little bit there, Austin?
Sure. So everyone's out of Scrooge's hair. And with that sudden burst of motivation, you know, threatening Al Jackal and everything after everyone's gone, he goes to get the nephews out until he realizes that they were not there at all. And had El Jackal taken Scrooge up on his proposition, then Scrooge probably would be left alone and probably beaten to pieces by El Jackal. So he goes in to look for the nephews and can't find them anywhere until he realizes that there's actually one of Louis's whistles on the ground. So he figures he'll just blow the heck out of it and use it as a signal to lead the boys out from wherever they are deep in the caverns.
Right. And crucially, he says he's just going to keep turning the knob and blowing until he gets a screech that will carry for miles. So we see that he's going to make all kinds of calls here. You guys, I am just a huge sucker for this next sequence. I love the way this story closes. We flash back to the ducks, the other ducks in the cave, and it works. You know, Scrooge's plan works because they hear it. Wolf calls, buffalo bellows. Uncle Scrooge is blowing signals to guide us out. So they reconvene with Louie in a catacomb fork, and they're able to make their way out. And as they leave the temple, Donald and the nephew holler to stop blowing, Uncle Scrooge, stop blowing. And this has to be read in its sequence because it's got some really good comic timing. Scrooge says, thank goodness you're safe. And Donald says, you wouldn't kid us? Look behind you. And he points and he motions over Scrooge's shoulder. And you guys, Barks just perfectly ends this little moment, this little mini cliffhanger at the end of the page, so that the reader is forced to turn the page and the reader knows what's coming. But it's still just a delightful surprise. Bucket, do you want to lay out the scene that greets Scrooge?
The scene that greets Scrooge is basically the cast of the Wild Thornberries. But it is a menagerie of animals: elephants, rhinos, lions, warthogs, gorillas, anteaters. There's a goat. There's an alligator and a bunch of birds, which feel more out of place than everything else here. But like, how loud that whistle has to be to call animals so far, because they're basically in Egypt. But some of these animals, or actually most of these animals, are not found in Egypt. Right. Like it all.
Right. There's a lot of sub-Saharan animals here. There's no way they could cross that distance in the time. We're figuring there's probably not a giant zoo just a few miles away. So it's very cartoon logic here. But this is in keeping with a long tradition of this type of cartoon logic gag. It works enormously well for me. I find the panel both just delightful in the comic sense, engrossing in how much fun he must have had drawing all these animals. I absolutely love this sequence. Austin, what about you? What did you think of it?
I agree. I'm a big fan of it. I think it's fun. I think it's funny. I like that all the nephews just grab a random ticket and immediately scale the cliff to get out. I think it's interesting because we started the story by talking about the two separate storylines, which was the story of the mines and the story of the whistles. And in my mind, the best way to go about that story would be to mix the two and end the story with those two. But actually, they've sort of separated again here, where by the time all animals are coming, the arc of the mines has sort of ended. And as we're going to see, the story's ending sort of relies entirely on the whistle as opposed to anything relating to the mines.
Well, I would say that the mines are almost the third element of it, right? Because where we start out is like the animal whistles and the travel. So I get what you're saying, but in a way, this is those two coming back together. But it's such a fast-paced, action-packed, and frantic ending. You know, because you mentioned what's about to happen as they run from these animals, they back into the temple. They realize that a pack of panthers and wildcats have come through the back adits. Do you guys know what an adit is? That's one that I had to look up as an adult. I mean, I can get it through context, but it is a narrow passage that is dug to connect this kind of like subterranean space. I don't know if Barks is just showing off at this point or what, but what a great word to include here. So at this point, they're surrounded. Scrooge yells out, "Everybody grab a chunk of ticket and scatter for their lives." And it's so over the top and so entertaining that I'm totally willing to overlook kind of the ridiculous logic that, you know, they're not just going to run for their lives a couple of miles to escape the animals. They're going to run and they're going to keep running until they make it to the airports. Because they scatter up the cliffs, and then we transition back to Scrooge's office, where he staggers into it in Duckburg some days later. and we've only got one page left here, but Barks even does a little tease with this moment, where he has the clerk ask Scrooge, "Bucket, do you want to read what the clerk says?"
"Mr. McDuck, we've been dying with curiosity, know what happened," and Scrooge goes, "Plenty. What's new at this end of the line?" And he's like, "Your nephew, sir, are calling from some of the strangest places in the world for passage home." And like, "So your nephew Donald is stranded in South Orkney Islands. Your nephew Dewey is in Thule, Greenland." And Scrooge's like, "Oh my, such expensive places to come home from." And he goes like, "Your nephew Louie is broke and homesick in Fayfek, New Guinea, and Huey is calling from the Vale of Kashmir." And Scrooge sort of takes that deep breath and gives looks like, "We'll send them passage home on one condition." Like, "What's that, sir? That if they have any more junior woodchuck animal calling whistles in their possession, they can doggone well whistle their way home."
I love this closing, you guys. I think it works wonderfully because of just it implies so much mayhem. And this passage of time is only a few days, but it's clearly just been a massive ordeal. What do you think about this ending here, Austin?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's funny in the sense that there hasn't been a lot that Scrooge has done to sort of deserve like what he's getting now. He's got to pay for all this fare and he's just going to all this trouble. But I think it's just a funny way to end it because it's so nonsensical that everyone is just like scattered across the world now and they all just have to get home. They have no money whatsoever.
It is nonsense, right? The idea that they just had to take the tickets and keep going. But it works so well in the cartoon logic sense. I love this. I am a total sucker for this story, guys. Let's go ahead and kind of transition to our overall thoughts. And I know I'm kind of bursting with it. I usually let you guys go first, but I'm on a roll here. I think that this is among the best pure treasure hunts, the best comedic adventure stories that he's ever done. There are no grand themes. There is no deeper, like, you know, back to the Klondike, that sort of search for lost youth. Or, you know, there's no like only a poor old man kind of pondering the futility of success. But it is just such a fun, pure adventure story. None of his stories have done sort of the travelogue thing half as well, right? Fabulous Philosopher's Stone had this sort of like really exciting trek, almost, you know, the Indiana Jones travel by map thing. But that was pretty much dedicated to like the Mediterranean and the just that one region. This is like this really fun globe-spanning adventure that is just so skillfully weaving together these two and then three elements into a really cohesive, just wonderfully entertaining story. So that's me. How about you, Bucket? You want to tell us, Bucket Think Tank, what are your overall thoughts on this one?
I like this story. It's just a good adventure. That's all there is to it. You mentioned Back to the Klondike and Only a Poor Old Man. I think that sort of is what sort of holds the story back from being, you know, somewhat bigger or somewhat more popular, is there's nothing else going on. But sometimes you just need a story that's like a good old-fashioned adventure. You know, we're going around the world a bit, seeing a bunch of new stuff, finding out that Scrooge has no particular area where he does business. It's just sort of everywhere.
Right.
Which is always good to see. You see the nephews having the most broken book in history once again. Like, it's so small, but it translates every language. It has Jason and the Argonauts. You know, it's beautifully ridiculous. We see it's an amazing whistle.
It's the Junior Woodchuck plot resolver.
Oh, a plot resolver. It does it all. It does it all. All right. This is what was in the suitcase in Pulp Fiction. All right. The Junior Woodchuck guidebook. That's why it was that important. All right.
There you go. Excellent. What about you, Austin? What's your take on this one?
Yeah, I totally agree with you guys. It's fun. It's a fun story. It's got a lot of energy. I think some Bark stories, like Only a Poor Old Man and Back to the Klondike, try to fit in like this Scrooge backstory, and they almost have like morals or messages, which is great because those are really good stories. But I do agree that every once in a while, you just need like a fun, like riot of an adventure. And so here's this animal whistle that will summon any creature. Here are these old mines. Here are 1,200 locations around the world that Scrooge has to get to and have a lot of fun with it. So I think it's a really cool story. Like I said, it's not as thick or deep or like meaningful as the story could be, but that's not why we read comic books. You know, we read comic books to have fun. And I think this story does a really nice job at achieving that goal.
Yeah, well said. I totally agree. Sometimes you just need a good adventure, and this is a good adventure. And he fits in two high concepts, right? I mean, the woodchuck whistle is definitely the standout. But that ticket, the idea of a ticket that needs two boys to carry it, it just cracks me up. It's great. So you guys, that's what we think about it. We're all kind of ranging from, you know, it's a very good story to me being like just shy of superlative. But how about the overall duck community? We always like to check in on Index, where fans can look up information about Disney comics and also rate their favorite stories. And this one has a pretty fine rating. It gets a 7.7 out of 10, which is, as of right now, good for number 158. So you guys, that's a fine rating. I've done the very nerdy thing of breaking out all of the Bark stories and making like a spreadsheet that contains all of the adventure stories, just so that I could see where they all fall in relation to each other, right? And that's the only way to compare them, because the Bark stories are generally ranked so much higher than the other creators. And then it's not fair to compare the 10 pages to the adventure stories. So if you look at that, you'll find that it's in the top half of his adventure stories. It's in probably the top, I didn't do the math, but it's got to be in like the 40th or 45th percentile or so. And you guys, I would say that that qualifies this story as underappreciated. Because to me, this is a really strong adventure story. It may not be like an all-time great. It may not be an all-time classic. But I would definitely say that this is better than that. It is not only better than like, you know, 6 out of 10 stories. To me, this feels more like a top quarter or so of his stories. So that's my lukewarm take, is that this story, while well-reviewed, is actually overall underappreciated by the community. Any thoughts?
I think what it's really lacking is just an interesting antagonist. Like, L. Jackal is just kind of insert villain of the week here. But, yeah. You know, stories often are made or broken by their antagonist. And this could have been, like, had we gone the DuckTales route, we probably would have put Out of the Beagle Boys a Glumgold in this. And I think that would have been fun, but I also think that changes the story too much. Like, if you put in an established villain, that does sort of change how the story has to go. You might not be able to get as much as going to India or Arizona or Sweden or whatnot. So you would lose something there. So I think that is sort of like the pro-con issue of that one. But like we also said, there's not much in terms of like, we're not deconstructing any character here. We're not looking at this other side of Scrooge's morality, you know, what makes him tick. It's just sort of, again, the fun adventure. And sometimes you do want a bit more, but, you know, we're looking at this sort of after the fact, you know, when we have the plethora of Box's entire library.
Right. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I'm actually shocked that it isn't in the top quarter or so of Bark stories, because I think the people on Indox are real suckers for like a really authentic treasure hunt. And I think that's what The Mines of King Solomon is. It's interesting to me that that's not higher. I feel like it shouldn't be as low.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a fine rating, but certainly could be higher. So let's see. Let's kind of transition to talking about, you know, follow-ups and the like. This one has never, to my knowledge, had like, Barks didn't do a follow-up. Don Rosa didn't really do any kind of sequel. I wouldn't say this one lends itself to a sequel, other than, of course, bringing back the animal whistles. But I would say that, like, a lot of the sort of, this does a really good job of establishing Scrooge as this empire builder, right? This world traveler and world industrialist tycoon. So in that sense, there's been a lot of stories that really followed up on this, because this does a lot to establish kind of his international reach in a way that not a lot of stories have ever done before. So I guess that's noteworthy. And he didn't ever do any of his great oil paintings or lithos on this one that I'm aware of. I think that scene at the end with all the animals could have made for a pretty awesome one. But yeah, I think we did a good job of covering this one, guys. So I'll give in a moment, I'll ask you if you have any other closing thoughts. And of course, we got to check in on favorite panels. We always like to highlight panels that maybe we think deserve a little bit of extra attention. The one that I really noticed, obviously there are some real attention catching ones, you know, like the animals arriving and the other splash panels of those sequences during the world travel. But I really liked the one where Scrooge just arrives back into his office at the end and he just collapses into his chair. You can just, there's so much unsaid in that, right? The ordeals that he's been through. How about either of you guys? Any panels that you'd like to highlight as a favorite?
I really like the opening one. Just to see Scrooge sort of like, you know, running the office is not something you tend to see. Like I said, a lot of, I think the ones that stand out to me the most for opening is just usually Scrooge in that dark room going, who owes me money? So this is nice to see that, you know, he's actually, you know, making sure everything's working. The first appearance of El Jackal, I really liked. I almost called him El Captain. I like that. Seeing him, also how angry and evil the camels look in that first appearance was great. And I think if I had to pick a third one just to round it out, it would possibly just be the scene where Scrooge is like coming out of the urn and there's a diamond on his head. I'd like that one.
Yeah, that's a great one. Good choices. I'm glad you mentioned the office scene because I also loved all the clerks carrying the ticket. What about you, Austin?
I agree on the opening panel. I really like Scrooge as a businessman or like a manager. I think that works really well with his like determined character. I like the sort of splash panel where the whales crash onto the pier and the ducks are running away. I'm also a big fan of the El Jackal introduction as well. I think the camels look like eerily realistic there. Like they look nothing like cartoon camels. They're really creepy. And of course, I'm a big fan of the splash panel at the end with the stampede coming at Scrooge.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, you guys, any closing thoughts before we wrap it up?
I'm going to say it again, from a DuckTales standpoint, the closest thing they have to this is the Treasure of the Golden Sun story. And that is far too big for this. From a treasure hunting standpoint, this story is actually pretty intimate compared to what you would do with a cartoon. The Treasure of Golden Sun, I think, is like a 5-part story. And I have no idea who El Capitan is. I have no idea who he is because he never showed up again. But he made no sense. But the scene where Scrooge just sort of loses his mind in front of all that gold is somewhat similar to this one. Where he's not thinking.
Loses his senses a little
The old gold fever. Yeah,
that's right. Well, excellent. Gentlemen, I really appreciate you joining me. Thank you for letting me effuse, gush over this one. Hopefully, folks will check out we've got a social media presence. We'll share a lot of cool stuff on the Facebook page, Bart's Remarks, some stuff on Instagram. Bucket, I know that you are working on a fun sounding YouTube video.
So we are doing our next DuckTales lore video. Our DuckTales lore this time will be Huey, Dewey, and Louie. We're just going to talk about the character from the cartoons, the comics, to present day. Huey, Dewey, and Louie are interchangeable in the Barks era and the Rosa era. If you say you can tell them apart without their hats on, you're probably lying to me. There's someone who can tell. There's actually a story where Donald can apparently tell them apart without their hats.
Yeah, that's a fun one.
It's hilarious. But yeah, that looks to be fun.
Nice. Well, we will happily share your nephew's video. Happy to share that. That sounds like a lot of fun. Austin, anything you want to promote these days?
No, I've been kind of laying low. I'm working on a couple things, so maybe next time I'm on, we'll get to talk about something. Maybe not Barks related, but we'll see what goes on.
Yeah, for sure. I should mention, Bucket, that most likely this month is, you can look for a special episode that Bucket and I did talking about Barks and DuckTales adaptation. So a little something different, should be a lot of fun.
I had fun.
Yeah, it was a good time. You guys, thank you so much for joining me. And we already read the final panel. So you guys, what are your favorite of the animal calls? Maybe we can go out on one of the animal calls. Oh, really quickly, join us next time, folks, as we get to cover the Christmas-themed story, The Black Pearls of Tabuyama. I really like that chug gluck. How about you guys?
It's the chug gluck. It's the chug gluck.
All right. So a hearty chug gluck to you both and to all. Thanks again, guys.
No problem.
See ya.
Hello, and welcome to Barks Remarks, the podcast where we talk about the stories from the legendary Carl Barks, creator of Scrooge McDuck and writer and artist of the greatest Donald and Scrooge comics of all time. Join us as we explore his longer adventure stories in their chronological publishing order. We'll talk about what makes them so enduring, their historical context, and how well they hold up today. So get out your reprint and get ready to enjoy our remarks.